Hey guys, welcome to another episode of Right Owl Politics. My name is Ariana Mendez, your host, coming to you from Miami, Florida. Today's episode is all about American history, but with a millennial twist. So to discuss American history, the good, the bad, and the ugly, I have invited my friend, Carlos Fernandez, historian, interior designer, friend of the show, to come and chat with us. So without further ado, let's jump right in.
Hello.
Hey, welcome to the show.
I know.
You've been kind of MIA. What happened?
Oh, well, you know, it's been productive and very lucrative past couple of months, so it's been a little bit difficult for me to get back on the show. Clients are demanding economies thriving back. You know, the good old Trump stances are actually happening, so... You know, Carlos is busy, and hopefully all of America is busy.
So what do you think of the president being nominated for a Nobel Peace Prize?
I agreed with the Norwegian person who actually nominated him, saying that he actually did something as opposed to Barack Obama, who did nothing to get his or got his because of an quote unquote apologetic tour that I didn't understand.
I honestly think Barack Obama got the Nobel Peace Prize simply because he was the first African-American president and people thought he was eloquent. That is literally why he got that prize.
But isn't that racism by definition?
I think so. But
I think
I
so,
know?
Too. I know. You're not judging someone based on their character. You're just judging them based on their skin tone.
Right. See, I'm kind of old school. I think you should judge people on their actual accomplishments because anybody can talk.
Without question. And that is the very essence of MLK's major speech that I think is the most troubling thing of all these protests, is that you guys hadn't learned your history and you haven't learned what he was actually saying. I want my white and black brothers and sisters to hold hands and be one and not see each other for the color of their own skin.
You know what's more troubling than that, though, is that Trump can't even catch a break. You heard what they were saying, that he apparently is now anti-military. I mean, what else can they accuse this guy of?
He's anti-military. Okay, so here's my viewpoint towards that. A, yes, he does not want to put Americans into conflict where there doesn't need to be one. And B, he's given them the most funding than any other. Reagan gave them more funding. And you have to go back. That's what. So we're in 2020 and Reagan was elected in 1980. So we're talking about 40 years.
Wow. I just felt old. Do you remember when we used to talk about the 80s and that was just like two decades past? Now we're talking about 40 years out.
Well, I mean, you're old. I get it.
You are technically older, just saying.
Age is but a mindset, my dear.
So are you voting in person or?
Oh, without question. I voted in person every election. There's no reason why I should not have voted in person today. If you can go to a Starbucks and get your, you know, mocha, cappuccino, macchiato, whatever you want to get. And if you can get that by going inside the Starbucks and waiting for your little coffee, and you're going to get it, and you can, with your mask on, socially distance, and then you can leave, I think you can go into a voting booth, socially distanced, with a mask on, and vote.
Yeah, people are taking this to the extreme in a very unreasonable manner. And now in LA, they're even canceling Halloween. Like, that's where I draw the line. Can the kids at least go out? They're wearing masks. Doesn't that check?
Well, yeah, I know. It's actually required masks.
Right.
Because it's Halloween.
Right. So if your kids have candy, just disinfect the candy when it gets home and let them have it. What's wrong with that?
Well, I think the other issue with that is they don't know where to stop. So, okay, what limitations are we willing to accept and what limitations we consider to be challenging to our normal understanding of rights in this country. And I think that's the conversation that needs to be had. I mean, yes, should you wear a mask to protect others and yourself? I'm not going to argue against it. I'm like, fine, whatever. But a mask is a mask. It's not that big of a deal. But to literally say to individuals that you cannot even celebrate the normal things that you're normally accustomed to celebrating, these are nationwide celebrations, and you're told you are to deny them this year because of a virus that affects horrendously to only a specific part of society, is kind of, I just don't understand where the logic comes from.
I also think they're underestimating American ingenuity. Americans will find a way to celebrate Halloween. Just this morning, I was reading an article that led me to a YouTube video about this couple had made basically what is a candy slide, which basically is this contraption that would respect the 6 feet distance, but the candy can be put into the slide and it comes out on the other side and the kid can get the candy and no corona was transmitted in the use of the slide. So,
Yeah, but at the same time, I'm like, I don't even think you got to go through all that length to do Halloween. We're going to get a vaccine. We know that the vaccine is coming. It may not be November, it may not be October, even though we're trying really hard to get it there, but the vaccine is coming. And we know who this affects the worst, right? I think that there has to be like, okay, listen, do I personally have this many health ailments that if I caught this, would I be in dire need of help? If you're a healthy person, you're like, I can probably survive this. And actually, overwhelmingly, the data shows that most people, over 90% of people that get this, survive it.
well, I think the only concern is the long-term effects of it, right? We don't know enough about the virus to know what are the long-term side effects of contracting it.
Oh, I mean, okay. So my viewpoint towards that is I look at history and I look at past, which are considered aviation flus, which is what this is, flus that came from birds, and this is one of those kinds of situations. And you look at it and you're just like, it's like a flu. It's just like any common disease. It's very, very bad. And when you get hit, by the way, I am not commenting to anyone on this show that this is a fun disease to get. This is not a fun disease to get. You should not get it. And if you do get it, you will probably survive it, but it is going to be painful and excruciating, right? So I want that to be considered, but at the same time, I also want you to understand that you have rights and you have certain things that you can do. And yes, there's a risk, but there's a risk for driving your car, right? There's a risk for going outside. There's a risk for seeing daylight. And unfortunately, we have to make those risks. And if you're not able to make those risks, I just think that you're just a you're a victim to fear.
Well, and I think life has to go on, and I mean, I understand gatherings cannot be business as usual. You still have to have the restrictions, respect guidelines, but at the same time, we need to work, we need to eat, we need to live. We can't
Oh,
just be on the sidelines.
I will use the Democrats. I will use their line from their god, President FDR. The only thing to fear is fear itself.
Touche, which that's a nice segue to today's topic. So, tell our audience what we're going to discuss today.
Okay, so I thought that, and I actually was talking to a friend of mine about this because I kind of wanted to get this a microdome of understanding to all the people who are listening. So I decided that I was going to write the top 10 things that I think the United States did poorly in, and the top 10 things that I think the United States did very well in. And I think that's a very good way of knowing not only your political stance on things, it also is very telling of what how you feel about it, right? And I thought it was a good conversation because oftentimes, and it's really hard to get past the president's make a great America great again because we're always great, we're amazingly great, we're always doing great. And I'm thinking, okay, we need the left to know, and we need the center to know that yes, we accept that there has There have been mishaps. There have been tragedies. But there's a certain spirit within our own identity that makes us amazing. And this is why. And I think that that's not clearly described, nor is that clearly pronounced. The president tries his best at it. And the problem is that when the left listens to it or the center listens to it, all they hear is, we're great. We're always going to be great. You know what? You're going to be great. You know why? Because I'm here. And I think that giving context to why we're great, why we think we're great, and even accepting the tragedies that we've committed and knowing how we tried to rectify them, no, that's what makes us great.
So let's do this. So I came up with my list and you came up with yours. Let's start with the bad and let's end with the good. How about
sure.
that?
Sure. It should always be that way.
All right. So you'll say one, I'll say one, and so on and so forth until we go.
So we're going to be sparring. Okay, fine.
Yes. All right. So let's start with the negatives. You go first.
Slavery.
Ah, that was my first too. Okay. Awesome.
And you know what? It's important that we say it, because what I want all listeners to understand is that everyone across the aisle, everyone in this country does not agree that slavery was a good thing. And that slavery was kind of a stain on our history.
Even more than a stain, I think it's the sin. The greatest sin is slavery. Taking somebody's life and making that person your property is probably the worst thing you can do to any living human being. And the fact that that was institutionalized as long as it was, not just in the United States, but worldwide, it's a very disappointing chapter of human history.
Yeah. And by the way, slavery also exists in the Bible. Slavery exists in every facet of human history. Just because us Americans have had slavery for about 150, actually less than that, from 1776 all the way to, yeah, about 100 years, 100 and change, we had slavery, does not necessitate the idea that we are uniquely providing this institution in the world. Slavery has been an institution for thousands of years prior to us participating in it. Not to negate the fact that we committed the crime. I'm not saying that. I'm saying that the crime committed was a crime committed by the populace of the world, as opposed to the populace of one individual nation, which it should be understood in those realms, because as a historian, we can't impose our moral distinctions of the present time to the moral distinctions of the past. We have to take the past for what it is at its time, for the understanding of its time.
I agree. So that brings me to my
It's your turn.
Civil War. And let me explain why.
Wow.
Yes.
Not on my list, by the way, I have to argue.
Yes. So here's the thing, why. If you want a conflict, probably the most deadly conflict in U.S. history, the amount of Americans who died in that conflict, brother against brother, geographic location against geographic location, a complete split of the United States, among party lines, Democrat versus Republican, South versus North, probably one of the most tragic chapters in history. And really, the wounds of the Civil War are still with us, and some of the issues that are currently in our country with race relations, with our understanding of that time period, are plagued by the consequences of the Civil War and the mixed results of the Reconstruction era. So definitely, I think, not our nicest period in our history.
Well, I'm not going to make any qualms about this. I'm a Southerner at heart, so there's a little bit of things that I did not like what the North did as far as what... I mean, all things considered, there was... Yes, it was a tragic, very tragic war. Sherman's March to Sea is considered one of the most disastrous American tragedies known to human history. Just for people who don't know this, Sherman was a general under the Union Army, and he decided that in order to subdue the South, he had to psychologically subdue them. And by doing so, he burned every city, every town from Atlanta to Savannah, and he did not burn down Savannah. Savannah is the only city in Georgia from to the East Coast that has maintained its structural understanding because of the fact that it was now burned or destroyed by Sherman's march. So that being said, there was tragedies also done by the South. I'm not gonna, I mean, yes. So I agree with you. There was a lot of it's just like a divorce. It's just not a pretty sight to see something like that. And it was there's certainly not a situation that was how can I put this, morally righteous for either party.
I agree. Your turn.
So I decided that I was going to put the next thing as the War of 1812.
Interesting. Explain.
So the War of 1812 is probably the only war, or actually it would be one of the three wars in my perspective that America didn't win. It was a stalemate between the British. We burned down their capital in Canada. They burned down our capital down here. Yes, did we get a the Star Spangled Banner song out of it? Sure, but it was pretty much who can pee the longest competition, so to speak. So it was pretty much, and of course, you will never see in any of your history books that we lost that war. Because we didn't lose it, but we didn't win it either because we didn't gain anything and they didn't gain anything. We just had a war because the grandchildren of the revolution, who never had a war, were egging on for a war, and we had to have a war because it was for the glory of it. And it was basically a total failure as far as the glory aspect of it.
It was kind of a silly war, if you think about it.
It's a very silly war. All we did was antagonize our Canadian neighbors to the north, and it provided kind of this basic, like, okay, the English are not going to attack us anymore, and we're just not going to attack the English anymore. We're done with that.
Right, prohibition.
Oh, I vouch for
No,
that.
it works for everything in life, right? You tell a kid don't do that, and that's the first thing that they want to do. You tell an adult, hey, you can't do that, and that's the first thing they want to do. So prohibition, well-intentioned by the group that supported it at the time, really goes counterintuitive to the American character of making people accountable for their own decisions and allowing people to make those decisions. And restricting that behavior only created a black market. So if you wanted a drink, you had to go to one of these speakeasies because it was at the time illegal. What a bunch of hooey. And what did that do? Just create a criminal element where there was no need for that criminal element to exist. Though the Kennedys, as bootleggers, were really made their fortune on that time period. So we can thank Prohibition probably for the Kennedy dynasty in a way. With that said, what a counterintuitive policy and amendment.
Could I say that I would have been a bootlegger?
I'm sure you would have.
Listen, I agree with you. That was probably, I didn't even think of that. So I'm happy that that was brought up because that was something I did not have on my list, to be honest with you. So that's fantastic. And he's sitting here thinking, okay, well, it's a Thursday night, which for all you listeners, I don't work Fridays. So tomorrow's my day off. So I'm like, oh, what's the next drink I'm gonna have? But that's why I like that. That was cute. All right. So my side, I'm gonna go with the Trail of Tears.
Oh, that's on my list too.
So the Trail of Tears, for those who don't know, was Andrew Jackson's kind of way of trying to temper the animosities of Americans towards Native Americans by transplanting Native American people to lands in the West through a trail of tears because they, and it's called Trail of Tears because they were mistreated and they were not adequately given food and shelter to provide them through this trail to the Western lands so they can build their own areas. Needless to say, those Western lands were not really inhabitable. They were, of course, within deserts, and they were not very nice. So it was a complete tragedy because it basically cost a quarter of all Native American life. So if you think of it in those terms, it's quite disastrous. In my perspective, this is where I take a step back and I call it a tragedy, not a mistake. And the reason why is because if you look at Jackson's own diaries, he clearly states that he is doing this trying, this is a clear case of no good intention. All good intentions are paved in the road to hell. I mean, this is purely that perspective. He is basically trying, the South is willing to go to war with the Native Americans, and he's trying to stop it. And by doing so, he's trying to transplant all these people to places where there's not that animosity. But by doing so, he has basically destroyed a lot of the Native American culture.
And it's interesting, every time the Trail of Tears is portrayed as a artwork or in literature, it is sometimes the most moving of portrayals because the imagery, the Trail of Tears, and what that triggers, it tells the story very well and what happened to these native populations. It is really one of the more depressing chapters of Western expansion, if you think about it.
Well, and just so we're clear, I'm not trying to negate the fact that the action was committed and the fact of its consequences were worse than its promise. But I'm not saying that the promise came from a place of hatred. Actually, Jackson adopted a Native American person, right? He adopted a Native American son. He loved Native American culture. He didn't want to go against that. He was just trying to save it, and he saved it in the worst possible way. But that's not coming out of a place of hatred, it's coming out of a place of love. And that's what I want to make clear, because I've read so many diaries from Jackson, and he hated himself because of that.
Interesting. My turn.
Good.
Vietnam. Do I even need to say more?
Well, we can all thank the other Democratic God for that. So that would be the great LBJ, Lyndon B. Johnson, that everyone looks towards JFK, but JFK only promised to provide soldiers to train officers of certain things, but LBJ is the one who actually put boots on the ground, so to speak. So yeah, go ahead. Tell me all the reasons why Vietnam was not a great
Well, let's see. Blood and treasure, American blood and treasure, and no really a significant progress or success as far as the reasons why we went into Vietnam at the end of the war. And what bothers me the most about Vietnam is to disrespect the soldiers, the veterans coming back from the war received from the general population. If you think about it, Vietnam vets are as you would expect, respected because of their service. But at the time, they were the butt of many jokes, disrespected by civilians. They're one of the few veterans that don't have a memorial in DC commemorating them. And it's sad if you think about it. These men served, were called to serve, went overseas to foreign lands to advance an American interest. And when they came back home, because the war was so unpopular, they were consistently disrespected. So it was just a loss all around.
Yeah, I think that if you, it's a challenging war. It's a war that it had very little to go on with very little to sustain it. And it's basically, it's such a challenging statement to even try to defend that action, even trying to say, okay, well, Lyndon was just trying his best. I think Lyndon's perspective was, I can win this, I can win this, I can win this. I just need more men and more firepower. And then it got to a point where James McNamara, who was the Secretary of Defense at the time, was lying to newspapers because he knew that he could not win this war with more men and more firepower. And when that got to the Post, it just became horrible, right? So there is this, that type of war was a self-defeating personality war. It's this, I will win this. This is winnable even when there is nothing in front of you that says that it is. And it's a huge risk to say that it is. And you took that risk, but those risks come with consequences. You can either have great reward or it comes with great, great casualties. And that's what happened. We got great, great crash casualties instead of successes.
All right, your turn.
So if we're, okay, so I had this more chronologically. So I went straight to, but I'll go to the 20th century. Let's talk about the atomic bombings of Hiroshima and Nagasaki.
Yes, that was a great failure. Yes, that was.
I don't think it was a failure. I still think it's a tragedy. And I'll tell you why. So speaking to, I have spoken to a lot of World War II vets, and my great-grandfather being a World War II vet, their viewpoint was the Japanese will not surrender by regular means. They will kill themselves before they will ever surrender. And we were not in a position to admire or you know, admonish the Japanese with thousands of American lives to get them to surrender. So I think that Truman kind of was put in a place where he said, if I did this, then I will save American lives because I wouldn't have to send an entire, you know, naval battalion and army scourge to try to get these, you know, self-killing Japanese to surrender. So there's a certain element of that that I can understand. But regardless of that, the traumatic experience of having an atomic bomb being placed in a civilian area, a city, because, I mean, Nagasaki, Hiroshima are not small cities in Japan. They were large-scale cities at the time. And to have a nuclear bomb just be set upon them for, and it could be, and I assure you, I'm sure that there is an element of that population that was certainly before the war effort and would kill themselves for the emperor, but they were still kids, they were still mothers, they were still girls, and brothers, and they were, and so that makes it a tragedy that we committed that, because never in American history have we ever committed so much civilian casualties to win a war.
You know, the reason I use the word failure, because I think that when atomic weapons are even considered as a viable option, diplomacy has failed at that point. And we're not just saying, hey, we're not talking, there's been a communication breakdown. Like, it's failure. This is not going anywhere. And the fact that the stakes were so high during World War II that was the only viable option that the U.S. had available, that just tells you that whole conflict.
Well, it was also brand new, right?
Right.
I mean, it wasn't like something we had a tried and true, oh, listen, we have this thing and we know what it's capable of. It was kind of like, there was duct tape on these there was duct tapes on the bombs themselves.
Well, I also think the novelty of it made it so much more appealing for them to use it.
Exactly.
So
because they wanted to, they wanted to see how effective it would be, right, in a war setting. So I get that, and I'm not disagreeing with that. But I also think that the attrition of the opposing party plays a role in that, right? Mm-hmm. What happens when all diplomacy ends because the person on the other side is willing to kill themselves before talking to you?
This, like I said, the stakes are high, but you have to put yourself in the mindset of American decision makers during that time. The European front is one conflict, but the war with Japan was very different. And I think acknowledging that and understanding that the Japanese, like you said, were relentless and were not going to concede otherwise, that must have been a very dark thought process for American decision makers.
And I think that that's what played into Truman's mind as far as, and by the way, for everyone who doesn't know this, again, Truman, just like Jackson, wrote in their memoirs and their diaries right after the event, saying it was the most regretful action they ever committed in their presidency. And they admit that that was their largest failure in their presidency.
So very Your sad turn. Period. U.S. foreign policy towards Cuba.
Oh, as a whole? Oh, come on. Bay of Pigs was probably the worst. I don't know why you would just say arbitrarily all this.
No. It was a mess from the start.
I'm going to let you take the Cuban side because I did not have Cuba on my list. So I'm a bad Cuban. I'm willing to admit that.
Yes, very bad Cuban. Your card is revoked. But no,
so from
the start, as Cuba transitioned from a Spanish territory and had this weird relationship with the United States, where the United States was interested in Cuba as a territory, but it allowed them to become independent after the Spanish-American War, to...
Can I intercede in just a moment? Because yes. Most people don't know how the Spanish-American War started. It actually started in Cuba.
Yeah.
A ship of ours blew up mysteriously. And because we were so ready to go to war with Spain, we blamed it on the Spanish. But that was yellow journalism when we found out that this ship was just old.
Right. It was just a convenient explosion at the time.
Exactly. So yeah. that's how we, and of course, Cuba was controlled by Spain since its inception. And we really wanted the Philippines and creating our own empire. So Cuba was given the excuse to do so.
Right. And Cuba was always coveted by Americans simply because of its geographical location in the Caribbean. It was just an ideal spot. With that said, they did agree that Cuba would be independent, which started Cuba on this dark path towards tyranny. Even as an independent country, Cuba never really got favorable treatment from the United States. And why do I say that? The United States supported Fidel Castro outright, calling him the Robin Hood of the Americas, which makes my
at the very beginning.
But they still did. They still did. And New York Times going down to Cuba and writing very favorable articles about Fidel Castro and how wonderful he was didn't help at all.
Well, and then our mafia going down there to control their cities was also not very pleasant.
Right. And then Bay of Pigs, which was a disaster.
That's probably the biggest scorn, the biggest issue.
Yes. And then the Cuban Missile Crisis, where JFK promises the Soviets, hey, we won't touch Cuba in exchange for you to removing the missiles, which basically sealed Cuba's fate.
Okay, but I think for your listeners, because there's certain, you know, American listeners who aren't of Cuban descent, I think it's important to describe what the Bay of Pigs invasion meant and why it was a major tragedy for American-Cuban relationships as far as those who were nationalists trying to reclaim their homeland.
Explain.
Okay. You're the one who said that. Fine. So Bay of Pigs, I get back my card now. I am a Cuban again because I'm explaining this. So
only half card.
No. If you can't explain this and you're letting me do it, I get my card pulled back.
You brought it up, so you.
I did because that's the most tragic part of the entire Cuban American relationship. So think of it this way. Castro gains control of half the country. He then turns to the communist side and said, I am a communist. I want to basically get rid of private property and I want to do whatever I want to the private property that I'm about to actually make an acquisition of. So,
well, no, I don't think acquisition is the proper term. He nationalized private
property. He nationalized all prior property.
Because acquisition, it kind of insinuates that there was some exchange of currency. No, it's kind of knock on your door.
Yes.
This was your house. Now it belongs to the Republic
Correct.
Of Cuba.
Absolutely right. So then you have a lot of Cuban nationalists moving to Miami because they don't agree with this sentiment. And then you have a president, JFK at the time, who was basically saying to the freedom fighters that were in Miami that if an invasion were to occur to overtake the communist or rule of Cuba, that there will be air cover. So the CIA, as well as the army, as well as the navy, and everybody else was training these group of nationalists in Miami to recuperate their nation. And when they went towards Cuba and actually fought for their own independence, the air cover that was promised to them by the Americans never actually arrived, because JFK thought that by doing so, he would spark another world war by going to war with Russia because of it.
And that was the first nail in the Cuban coffin at that point.
And it allowed, I mean, there has, I think there's more Cuban, I don't know about this in as far as history is concerned, but I can assume that the casualties committed on Bay of Pigs was probably the most tragic casualties in Cuban history. I mean, that kind of scenario is probably the most disgusting, just destruction of human life that you can even imagine. I mean, if you think of, as an American, I can't put this enough, but if you think of D-Day without having any of the Allies help,
It was that level of
it
tragedy.
was that level of tragedy.
I agree. Your turn.
Okay, so since we're in the 20th century, I should probably bring this up. Jim Crow.
Oh, I agree 100%.
So, for those who don't understand what Jim Crow was, after slavery and Reconstruction, the South decided that they're going to use the courts and the law system to provide a separate but equal institution of governance to the South that provided the African Americans or Blacks, depending on your political affiliations, to be treated differently than white Americans by providing separate but equal, quote unquote, institutions. And Jim Crow was the law of the day that provided that separation.
And I actually think that goes to one on my list, which is segregation. So Jim Crow is very much related to that mentality of separate but equal, even though that's kind of even theoretically counterintuitive, right?
Well, I mean, if you're separate, then you're certainly not equal. Same issue I have with liberals. If you want to separate yourselves, it is not equal. That's why we fought so hard to end this.
But definitely a very dark period in American history. And if any of you who are listening are not really familiar, there's some great films out there that really talk about this period and what were the effects, the human effects of segregation.
Yeah. And I think that that was a, again, these are Americans. I'm a nationalist at heart. These are Americans. They are American born. They are American citizens. They should be treated within the same realm of equality to our Constitution and our laws. There should be no benefit and no deterrent to participate in our contract to the Constitution.
I agree.
So there's mine. Go ahead.
Let's see. The drug war.
I don't have that on my list. Go ahead.
So the reason I say that, I'm going to put this
By the
is
way, her beloved president started it, just so we're clear.
Well, here's the thing. Let's say this. It was well-intentioned, but the amount of money that we invested in this endeavor, the amount of lives that have been lost in the process, and the issue of drug abuse and American dependency on illicit drug continues to be an issue today, and this has been going on for over 40 years. So obviously the strategy has not been effective. Have we been able to minimize? Yes. Have we been able to control the flow? Yes. Have we been able to extinguish it completely? No. So I think acknowledging that the approach that we've taken in the last 40 years have not produced the desired results is part of the analysis, right?
starting with the Reagan administration, just so we're clear.
Yes, and through the first program that comes to mind is DARE.
I love to jab this to her.
Yes, yeah. But let's be realistic. If you look back on it, all the money that we've spent, all the lives that have been lost in the process, all the laws that have been passed, and we still have the drug issues are still rampant in this country. And instead of lowering consumption, there are states that have, you know, thrown their hands in the air and say, you know what? Marijuana should be legal. Yeah. We're not going to do anything about it. So there was a will, there was a concern at one point in our country's history that, hey, we need to fight these drugs, but we haven't been able to extinguish them, nor the dependence. So we've just thrown up our hands and say, ah, who cares? And that really has been a waste of time and money.
I agree with you. I think that that's actually quite accurate. And so that leads to me to my, and I hate to bring this up, but this is another 1980s issue, American involvement in South America in the 1980s.
Yes, I agree. Yeah.
And just so I give clarity to your listeners, I am half Peruvian. So unfortunately for me, I get to hear all all the stories of why South America consider us the other, the North, the Yankee, the people we don't want to deal with. Because during the 1980s, we believed in the domino effect of communism, that if one state fell to communism, then the three other states surrounding it will then convert to communism, which would mean the next five states around them would also convert to communism. So we couldn't have that. But by defending the domino effect, we basically instituted and supported dictatorships in South America that killed innocent people and pretty much coerced them to do whatever they wanted. And that was unfair treatment to the South American people, and it probably hindered them and made them more extremist in their viewpoints regardless. So I thought it was very counterintuitive.
Definitely, even though I can see the wisdom to the policy from a U.S. perspective, it definitely fueled anti-Americanism in that region. And that sentiment is still alive today.
Yeah, it basically has scorned us in talking about Argentina. It has scorned us in talking about Bolivia. It has scorned us in talking about in a lot of other states. Obviously, because of our relationship with Chile, Colombia, and at some parts to Peru, as well as to other parts on the west, I guess it would be the western coast of South America. Sorry, I'm an Eastern boy, so I have to actually do the geographical determinations. There's a, you know, 50-50 chance that we're liked. But on the Eastern side, the Brazilian side, it's pretty much that we're not liked because of those decisions and because of the military actions that we committed during that time period. And that's not to negate from, I think, the idea that we don't want communism to spread. I think that's a very genuine, very, you know, good intention kind of thing. I don't think that we should be supporting and promoting leaders that commit the same atrocities on the other side.
I do think that yes, it did breed anti-Americanism, but it was successful at the time at stopping the spread of communism.
I think, okay, so Peru for me is the best example of what was the success story, because Peru didn't come from a place of like American intervention. And this could be my own, like, you know, support for my mother's heritage and my mother's family. But Peru's perspective was, we won't negotiate with terrorists, and it doesn't matter what the terrorist who the terrorist was, we don't negotiate. And actually that same sentiment was used by the Americans and used nationwide by the right, as far as that's concerned. But I believe that Peru came stronger by dealing with extremism by itself, if that makes any sense.
Fair enough. All right, my turn. Yes, U.S. foreign policy towards Middle East.
I disagree with you.
Oh, no, 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 no. This has been a disaster.
But Ariana, we inherited all of that. We didn't start the fire.
Sure. We didn't start the fire, but we made it bigger.
But okay. Just so your listeners know, this is the analogy I'm thinking of this. Here is Grandpa Joe telling all the countries of the Middle East, saying, you can have a country, you can have a country, you can have a country. And Uncle Joe is Europe, just so we're clear. And then here comes America, the toddler, saying, well, Uncle Joe's no longer here, but now I have to play with you guys. And I'm young, and you all seem interesting to me, so we're going to be meddle in. And I think, and by the way, every nation that we're going to probably talk about in the next segment at this moment in time, not invented by America, not instituted by America, not instituted by any Muslim faction, not instituted by any culture or language, instituted by two people, a British foreign diplomat and a French foreign diplomat, saying, you get a country, you get a country, and yes, you get a country too. And we're left with, oh my God,
a shitstorm.
How the hell do I regulate this?
But again, let's put it American-centric. The amount of money, the amount of lives that we have lost trying to solve the Middle East crisis is immense.
Correct.
And what do we have to show for it? Just a bunch of caskets with our young men and women in, and really nothing else that we can say. Oh, that we helped defend human rights. Okay, but at what cost to ourselves? And we probably perpetuated a lot of violence in those countries as a reaction to our presence there.
I couldn't agree more. I think that we are not the police of the world, and we shouldn't pretend to be it.
I agree. Yeah, it's dangerous being the police of the world.
Oh, without question, because when you come in, I mean, when you come in with an AK-47, you're going to be met by a cannon somewhere.
Right.
And just to make it very clear, the Middle East, but I truly want this to make this clear, the Middle East in its contextual issues that we're dealing with today isn't an issue that was born by the Americans or by American policy. It was born by World War I and World War II, where the Europeans had a say in the matter. But
I think our involvement is to try to fix some of those issues. And instead of fixing them, we just made them worse.
But it goes back to the good intention, bad outcome argument, right? Versus the Europeans was, who's going to pay me better to provide the outcome that's going to happen?
Sure. Yeah.
We're trying.
Your turn.
Yeah. Okay. So my turn. The genetic movements of the 1930s that led to the sterilization of Americans.
Interesting. All right. Tell me more.
So in the 30s, and by the way, this was practiced by Democrats for the most part, and no one will tell you this, but there was a genetics movement in the South that said that we're going to keep segregation instilled by basically sterilizing Black women and Black men, as well as white women and white men, whom intercoalesce to their respective races that were not deemed acceptable. There was a lot of sterilization going on based on color of skin, based on color, not just color of skin, but based on economics too. So if you didn't make a certain economic level, then they were considered, oh, well, you should really take this test, or do you want to make extra money and do this? And they wouldn't fully explain what they were doing to their bodies, but it was sterilization.
Wow, that's a very dark period.
No kidding. I mean, the genetics movement of the 30s was the very embodiment of the Nazi perspective of how they wanted to control race and genetics.
Hmm. Yeah. That if you guys have not heard about that, do your homework. It's actually quite troubling that that was a thing in the U.S. at that time.
Mm. Your turn.
Okay. So my last one is cancel culture.
To the modern perspective. Okay.
Yes. I'm completely done with this. Oh, I don't like what you say. I'm going to make sure you're either fired from your job, are a social outcast, or a social media outcast, which is the new modern trend. So the scarlet letter enthusiast of the world, yeah, no thank you. I'm allowed to have an opinion. You may not like my opinion. That doesn't mean that you're going to come after me on a personal or professional level. That people should learn to respect others and not try to destroy them just because of the opinions they have. More ideas are better. You need to be able to defend your ideas in a marketplace of ideas, not be intimidated by others' opinions.
I couldn't agree more. And that leads me to my last one, which is also a modern one, the Me Too movement.
Wow, that's controversial. Why do you
Oh,
say
no
that?
kidding. I'm going to get hate mail for this. Okay. So the Me Too movement has basically provided toxic relationship between the genders to say that anything that the female says or the recessive perpetrator says is that the perpetrator or the more dominant force is at fault for everything.
So, victim culture.
Yes, I think there's a specific word for it, victocrats, as far as and these are victocrats. I'm like, okay, listen, it's okay to feel victim for like a minute, maybe even a day, but it's not okay to feel that way the entire time. We're a country of contracts. We're a country of understanding. We understand our relationships. If you want and do something that abridges that contract, that is more personal, that's not a, in my perspective, a legal or public issue.
But see, the Me Too movement, we need to acknowledge something. Women have been on the receiving end of inappropriate behavior for hundreds of years. That's a fact.
Well, thousands,
With
if you
that,
go, if you, yeah. Sure.
yes, if you want to be technical about it, yes, thousands of years. Since women have been women, let's just say that. So acknowledging that, not every woman is a victim. And instead of trying to start a conversation about ways to change perspectives on women, try the presumption of guilt that is attached to a man who is accused of any of these types of wrongdoings is un-American.
Well, I think that if you look at history and who are the women that are celebrated and talked about, they're never women of victimhood.
Right.
Catherine the Great, Elizabeth the Second, Elizabeth the First, Victoria. These are women that
Amelia Earhart.
Amelia Earhart. I mean, if you're going to go to the American side, yeah, there's plenty of that. Eleanor Roosevelt would be one of them.
Ill.
You say ill, but she was a powerful woman, right?
Ill. No,
She was
that's the same.
powerful, though.
No, that's like
She made
mentioning
the
Hillary
UN. You can't
Clinton.
argue that. She made the
Who says
UN.
that's a, who said that was a good thing?
Oh, well. Okay. But
No.
regardless of the fact that our entire modern worldview is situated by these women, and here's my perspective on it. You don't win anything by coming from a place of victimhood. You win when you are the person saying, I own my history, I own my actions, and I welcome the consequences, and I will be unforgiving in them because that's where because they made me who I am today. And that is nothing to be ashamed of.
I agree. We are the sum of our experiences, the good and the bad.
Correct. If someone told me you did not do well at this situation, guess what? You learn more from your mistakes than your successes.
I agree. And there is that quote from Rudyard Kipling that says you need to face both triumph and disaster and treat them both the same. So, yeah, you need the good and the bad in life. You can't always have the good. So, with that, I'm going to invite you back next week so we can talk about the accomplishments slash successes. But good talk. Good
Absolutely.
talk.
I think it was great. I think that we both surprised each other by our answers.
Yes, and by the
Which is
sounds of it.
surprising, by the way, because we agree in a lot of things and we think very similarly.
Well, I think that there were commonalities. I think we both thought of slavery. We both thought of the Trail of Tears. I think you called it Jim Crow. I called it segregation. But I think as Americans, we are self-aware of our faults, but that doesn't mean we don't embrace our positives. And I think.
But yeah, and I absolutely agree with you. And I just want, and my overriding message here is that those on the right, those who are Trump supporters, those who you want to talk about as not being educated, we know those faults. We're readily available to admit them.
But we focus also on the good because America has brought a lot of good to the world,
Exactly.
which we'll talk about next week.
Exactly. But and we don't see these things as mistakes or major issues because at the end of the day, we weren't there to make these decisions. We can only say that the people that made those decisions were trying to do the best in the capacities and understanding of their time.
And there will be people after us that will judge our decisions and give out the same judgment.
Correct.
So, looking forward to that discussion with our grandkids. I'm sure there's going to be a lot of judging.
Oh, I'll just take my grandfather's perspective. I don't care what you think.
Get off my lawn.
Exactly.
Well, Carlos, thanks for coming on the show. We'll talk to you next week.
Thank you.
Guys, thank you so much for tuning in, and thank you to Carlos for being on the show. And make sure you tune in next week for part two of this special discussion on American history, a millennial's take. So, guys, remember, we are on every podcasting platform, Spotify, Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts being the main one. Spotify, of course, we love over there at Spotify. We're also on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram, so go check us out there. Instagram, it's Right Owl Politics. Twitter is Right Owl Podcast. And Facebook, you can find us by my name, Ariana Mendez. So check us out there. And remember, we're not your dad's political news show, so spread the word, tell your friends, make sure they know are about our show, and invite them to just tune in, check us out, give us an opportunity to entertain them for a bit. So guys, thank you so much for tuning in, and we'll talk to you next week.